This is the Bigger Pockets Podcast, show 43.
You're listening to Bigger Pockets Radio, simplifying real estate for investors large and small. If you're here looking to learn about real estate investing without all the hype, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and be sure to join the millions of others who have benefited from BiggerPockets.com. Your home for real estate investing online.
What's going on, everybody? This is Josh Dorkin, host of the Bigger Pockets Podcast, here with my co-host, Brandon Turner.
Thanks for not giving me a nickname this week, Josh.
Oh, man. You've been crying the past couple episodes, so I figure I'd go easy on you.
Tears have been shed.
They have indeed. They have indeed. How you been, man? Doing good?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great, actually. Yeah. Thanksgiving's right around the corner, and we're excited for that.
Yeah. We're at show 43. This is 43 weeks in a row, 43rd week of the year. It's crazy.
It has been crazy. We're coming up on the big 5-0. So
yeah, you know, it's bananas. But let's jump into this one. We've got kind of a cool show today with Sean Riley from Newton, Mass. Sean is a buy and hold investor who became a house flipper who also has purchased properties at long distance. And we're going to cover lots of cool stuff like, you know, what do you do if you live in an area that's pretty expensive, how to get started and things like that. We talk about, you know, craziness like buying a house that has railroad tracks in its backyard and sewage plants in the front. You will be amazed at what you can make money with. So check it out. Pay attention. If you've got any questions for Sean, check out the show notes at biggerpockets.com/show43 and be sure to ask him your questions there or check him out on the site. And otherwise, let's just jump in. What do you think?
Let's do it. By the way, I like how you said Mass instead of trying to say the whole name of the state. Let's hear you say it, Josh.
Massachusetts. Let's hear you say it, Brandon.
I'm not going to say it.
Come on. Well, you can say it twice.
I said it during the show once, and it was
awkward.
It was awkward. I worked my way through it.
Brandon,
that's all it's called.
Yeah, Mass. It's easy. Yes. So anyway.
You might think you want real estate, but that's not true. What you really want is passive income. With new investors struggling to find deals or get enough money to buy them and veteran landlords tired of the constant tenant phone calls, is there a better alternative? Actually, there is. Short notes from ConnectInvest. ConnectInvest is an online investing platform that allows you to easily participate in passive real estate investing, and all you need is $500 to start. Short notes collectively funds a diversified portfolio of commercial and residential real estate projects across acquisition, construction, and development phases. You'll earn a fixed monthly income without the hassle of owning or managing real estate. Head to connectinvest.com/BP to create your account. Fund your digital wallet with at least $500. Select from 6, 12, and 24-month short notes with annualized return rates up to 9%. Then sit back and let your monthly returns roll in. Join today by visiting connectinvest.com/VP. connectinvest.com/VP. Passive income without the property headache? It's possible. There's a way to invest passively in real estate and get monthly income without any tenants, maintenance, or property management. The Wealthy have been doing this for years, and if you're an accredited or high net worth investor, you too can collect cash flow without the headaches that come from owning rentals. How? By investing in a private real estate fund with PPR Capital Management. PPR's co-founder, Dave Van Horn, wrote the book on real estate note investing for BP. But he's not just investing in notes. Dave and his team also have an extensive background in commercial real estate. And with PPR Capital Management, they're strategically investing in both notes and commercial real estate nationwide. With over $500 million in assets under management, PPR has provided individuals with a steady source of truly passive income since 2007 without ever missing a payment. Check them out at investwithppr.com. Again, if you're looking to get monthly passive income from an experienced team with a strong track record, go to investwithppr.com today. This show is sponsored by Airbnb. Did you know that I turned one of my first homes into an Airbnb? It's true. And it even helped me get the extra income I needed to launch my real estate career. So if you want to try your hand at making even more income with your property, Airbnb is the place to be. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Let's do it.
All right, Sean. So welcome to the show, man. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited about it.
Awesome. Us too.
All right. So, Sean, let's get down and dirty here, man. All right. What kind of investor are you?
I do a couple different things. So I started off as buy and hold locally. And after a couple years, I started getting into doing fix and flips in my area in Massachusetts. And then a little over a year ago, I also started getting involved with out-of-state rentals.
Okay. Hey, what's the market look like where you're at? Because I know some area of Massachusetts is very expensive.
Most of Massachusetts is relatively expensive, even in the, you know, the real boonies and stuff like that. It's still more expensive than all, you know, like a lot of places in the country. Right around me, I'm.
Yeah, okay. my area is pretty boonies.
Well, I live right outside of Boston, so it's very expensive here. As I was saying, like I'm in, you know, $400,000 to $500,000 condo land.
Ooh, ooh,
nice. Yeah, that's got to be Cambridge.
Oh yeah, lots of them in Cambridge. I'm in Newton, which is right close to Cambridge, borders Boston. It's where Boston College is. Yes. I have one of my high school teachers didn't like it very much, so we would always call it the University of Newton.
Nice. Yeah, I actually lived right on the reservoir at BC after college. It was it's kind of a fun place to be. It's a cool town for 17 to 21 year olds.
Yeah, so I lived in Brighton, right near Newton, where you're talking about. So we actually probably had places pretty close to each other at that point.
Nice, nice, awesome. All right, so you started buy and hold, went to flipping, and then got to out of state rentals, and I guess we'll kind of cover that transition. How did you originally get into buy and hold?
So I had actually been interested in real estate for quite a few years, had read a lot of books, did a lot of studying, wanted to get into cash flowing rentals. Me and my wife bought our first place, which was that condo in Brighton I was just referring to. It was actually we bought on the wrong side of a flip back in 2004. And then in 2007, we wanted to move to a place that was a bit bigger because we were starting to think about starting a family and stuff. And a 663 square foot two bedroom condo was probably not where we were going to be raising a family. But as I said, we bought in 2004, went to sell in 2007, as opposed to eating like, you know, $30,000 or something to sell the place. We decided to turn it into a rental because we thought we should at least be able to cover our costs, which we have been able to do. And we had actually always joked that it was so close to BC that it would always make a good rental property if we didn't have to sell it. So that's how we got started there. So then after that, as I said, I'd already kind of been interested. So that sort of kind of got, you know, give me a little kick in the pants to get started. And we like the fact that people are just mailing us money every month.
That's always so, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll take it.
So what we did after that is I grew up north of Boston, a city called Lowell, which is right near New Hampshire. One of the other bigger cities in Massachusetts. Boston dwarfs everything else. But after that, it's one of the bigger cities in the state. So I grew up right outside of that, and most of my dad's family still lives there and stuff like that. So I knew the area pretty well. I was like, hey, you know, we can probably buy the same unit for like less than probably about 40% of what we paid for our place in Brighton. And we could get, you know, somewhere between 2/3 and 3/4 of the rent. So, we're like, hey, you know, let's start looking there. We actually bought two almost identical units, there, you know, 6-8 months after we first started.
Were these condos as well?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Actually, all my stuff in Massachusetts are condos.
Really? Okay.
For rentals.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Interesting. Well, let's kind of talk about that a little bit because, you know, a lot of people will shy away from condos. I know that I had a condo experience myself that did not go well. I loved where I lived. This was in SoCal, and you know, inherited a board of directors that you know felt like running a board was like running the universe, and they got very power hungry over a you know 40-50 unit building and you know started going crazy and doing bad things, and it gave me a very bad taste for living in such a place or ever owning a rental in such a place, because you know you're at the mercy of those folks. So have you ever had any similar experiences or how's it been for you?
There's definitely, you know, those things are definitely risks. I have dealt with, my places range from anywhere from just 5 units all the way up to several hundred. So like the small ones, you know, they're generally self-managed and stuff. So it really does depend if you have good people there. I've actually been pretty lucky. And for that really, really small one, the person who's in charge, the trustee there, is like awesome and is very easy to work with, very nice, does a good job of keeping things in order. We do have, actually, in our biggest complex, we had something kind of similar to what you had, like there were a couple of people who had been on the board forever and just had like, you know, crazy power trips. Mm-hmm. One was eventually voted out, which was very nice. But like for the first couple of years, if I went to the association meeting and stuff, like literally they had to have like cops and like the attorneys and stuff there just to like keep things in order.
Really?
But it cash flowed, so.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Well, the big thing for me was these guys didn't want to get earthquake insurance. And living in Southern California.
California is kind of a big deal.
Yeah, I owned the everything between my four walls, but you know, the building itself didn't have coverage, and that was a bit troubling. So interesting. So you put up with that stuff and continued to acquire condo properties after that. You're a braver man than I am.
It slowed down for a while, but that was actually more because like a lot of first time investors who, you know, buy rentals like the books tell you to do.
Yeah.
They don't make you nearly as much money as you were hoping.
Yep.
So kind of got in a holding pattern for a while. I've only bought one since those first three here.
Okay.
But I did buy, it was another condo and it was in the same area and the same basic unit and stuff.
Gotcha.
But you know, overall the thing I like about condos, especially if you're getting started and you have to do your due diligence on the association and all that kind of stuff,
yep,
is that if you want to self-manage your properties, it's a lot easier because typically, as you were saying, like, you know, you're responsible for inside your four walls, but you don't have to worry about exterior maintenance. You don't have to worry about, you know, cutting the grass, plowing the snow, you know, fixing a leaky roof, any of that kind of stuff. Like the association is in charge of that. Now you pay for that. That's why you have to, you know, you have to evaluate the fees and make sure it's worth it. But, if you consider that to just be part of your property management fees and your reserves and stuff like that, it's a good way to kind of get your feet wet because you don't have to deal with every single issue. You only have to deal with the stuff, like I said, inside your actual units. So easier to self-manage.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I think the scariest part other than the board is really those one-off assessments that tend to pop up every couple of years or every year, depending
on
your board.
I've paid 3 deck assessments and I don't have a single unit with a deck.
Yeah.
So that kind of stuff is frustrating.
Yeah, it could be. It could be for sure. So so for those people listening, you know, condos do have their benefits for sure. But there are also certainly negatives. Obviously look at your own risk tolerance and decide if an investment in a condo is really for you. But you know, if the numbers work and you're willing to put up with it, then it could definitely be a good deal. So, that's great. So this condo thing, you picked up a bunch of condos. Did you continue as a buy and hold guy? Were you continuing to pick up? Did you move to like single families from there, or was that kind of the, you know what, I'm going to move on to flipping houses now?
So what happened was after we got those first 3 units, the converted primary and the first two that we bought otherwise, as I said, like a lot of people didn't turn out to be as good of investments as I necessarily thought initially. So kind of got in a holding pattern for a while, sort of blew our wad with down payment money and stuff like that. And also, you know, since they weren't doing as well as we wanted to kind of take a step back and reevaluate how we wanted to do stuff. These weren't like killer investments where it's like, oh, you know, ended up going bankrupt and lost all the properties of foreclosure. It's just kind of like, you know, instead of cash flowing, you know, $200 a month, it's more like break even. So we kind of got in a holding pattern for a couple of years, sort of built my network and my knowledge, kept going to my local RIAs and other real estate meetings and stuff like that. And then always kind of wanted to get interested into the flipping stuff too. So just kind of like kept learning about that and sort of just, you know, kind of one day something just kind of like clicked and, you know, started just putting out tons and tons of offers to try to, you know, acquire some properties and, you know, started getting some. And ever since then, have you know, mostly been doing that around here. I did pick up one new rental locally about a little over a year ago. Which actually, so just to show what I learned in 5 years is that the it was also a condo in Lowell, more or less the same unit that I had bought the other two times, but I paid half as much.
Ah, there you go.
So that one, cash flow is a lot better.
Yeah, yeah. Sounds like it. I'll take it.
That's cool. So you started flipping then at that point. How did, I guess, what was your first flip look like? Did you mean to flip it, or I guess how'd that start?
So, like most people, initially I was thinking it's like, oh, you know, I should probably get into wholesaling because it'll be quicker, easier than, you know, going through a whole rehab process because, you know, I don't necessarily have enough money or connections or I've never done it before, blah, blah, blah. So, as I said, one day I just sort of clicked that it's like, you know, if I don't, basically it was like, if I don't start putting out offers, I'm never going to buy a property. So I started putting in tons and tons and tons of offers. Like, you know, basically the month I decided to really get into it, I probably put in like 200 offers.
Whoa.
Now, a lot of like kind of throwing stuff against the wall, like didn't really expect there to be any traction and there wasn't. Right. But, you know, eventually I did get, started getting some inquiries and stuff. So the first place I got under contract, I had hoped to wholesale. And I did work towards that. I actually had a buyer all lined up, and he was using hard money, and basically his lender backed out the day before the closing. So, like, you know, he was scrambling, and I was trying to figure out what to do with that. It was a bank-owned HUD property, so we were going to double close. So, you know, I had to perform or lose it, or you could get an extension. I did get a short extension. It was, you know, I had to pay like, you know, like $300 to get like a 2 week extension or something.
Okay.
Hoping that he would be able to get his finances in order. So he wasn't able to pull it together. So I, at that point, I was sort of at a decision point, and I was like, you know, I know this is a deal. It's like, you know, I've been studying this forever. I've been putting in these offers. I've been evaluating stuff. And it's like, I know there's like a ton of profit in this deal. So I was like, you know what, I'll close on it and then I'll keep marketing to see if I could wholesale it. So I did eventually close. It was like for Massachusetts, it was ridiculously cheap. It was like $34,000, I think I paid.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah. Sounds like I won't say it.
It needed more work than that. But, you know, but I was able to acquire. Actually, I remember at one point I looked up and it was like, since it was an MLS deal, I looked it up on MLS and it was like the cheapest any house had gone for. This was in Chicopee, Massachusetts. This was way west, you know, probably about 85 miles outside of Boston, which was actually part of the problem is I didn't have a network out there.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. But it was like the cheapest place that went on MLS for like 3 or 4 years before that and nothing cheaper since then. So that was one of those, like, you know what? If nobody has bought anything anywhere near this cheap, it's got to be pretty good.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I tried, kept marketing it, had a few tire kickers, you know, did like the Craigslist thing, going to the RIAs thing. Well, what's funny is there was actually a RIA that was out of Springfield, Massachusetts, which is the big border town, that like literally closed maybe like a month before I got the property.
Nice.
I was like, oh, just go out to the Springfield place. I'm sure there'll be buyers there. And then the next closest one was one in Worcester, Massachusetts, which is the second biggest city in the state and, you know, probably 30 or so miles from there. But I'm like, well, that's probably where everybody's going to be going now. And that one literally closed like the week. I luckily checked to make sure it was still, you know, to get the address. I went online to check it out and it literally had just closed.
Oh, so funny.
I was like, oh, well, I'm glad I didn't drive all the way out there to pitch the thing.
Wow. All right. So you got this property under contract. You decide you're going to close. Obviously, it sounds like you had the cash to close yourself. So you were able to actually do that.
Yeah, I didn't have to do anything too dramatic. I did have some cash. To be honest, I took like a huge credit card advance.
Okay.
To pay for it. So, you know, it's one of the other things people demonize sometimes is using a credit card. But in this particular case, I had, you know, a 0% for 13 month kind of offer. So I just, yep, you know, took the money out. That was more than enough to close on it.
I've done that a few times now. Yeah, I know people do demonize that, don't they? And I even am guilty, you know, of telling people, you know, be very, 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 very careful in doing that, and maybe don't do it at all. Well, but I do it. So.
And I'm the one who demonizes it, so y'all can look at me and make your little devil eyes at me. And
well, it's like I know it's dangerous. It's kind of like, you know, I don't know. There's a lot of bad vices in the world, but it's worked for me and it hasn't messed me up yet. So,
well, if you get a 0% loan for the 13, 16 months, I mean, it's better than hard money. I mean,
well, that's my point is if you get that kind of deal, it's like, well, why is it better to get a secured loan at like, you know, 12 to 15% with the same transactional fees for the same time period, you know?
Yeah, no, listen, I mean, if you look at it from that perspective, I think, you know, using a card on a, you know, with an offer like that is probably your best option if you don't have the cash.
Yeah, I wouldn't do the 30% cash advance fee or whatever, the, you know, like the really crazy cash advance charges, but yeah, those checks are nice.
Yeah, so these things are usually only either a 3 or 4% transaction fee, which is, you know, that's pretty typical what you're going to pay for hard money points. Yep. So you just avoid paying, like I said, the double-digit interest and all the other closing costs. And if, you know, if, God forbid, you actually do default on it, you don't lose the property.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
There you go. There you go. All right, so you've got this property now. You've been shopping it around to the clubs that don't exist, whose doors close and are conspiring against you. And you decide, you know what, I'm going to go ahead and flip this. Is that
exactly? So that's what happened when I was having a hard time wholesaling. Like, so I got a few tire kickers like off of Craigslist, and I actually called some of the We Buy Houses people who were out there, who did not get back in touch with me, which I was like, whoa.
Dang.
But so then I was like, you know, I just know there's profit here. So my biggest concern was, as I said, it was well out of my general area, so I didn't have a contractor out there. But somebody who I had been, so I hadn't done any flips yet, but somebody who I had formed a relationship with and had been looking at some local properties with agreed to go out there and take a look at the job. And his quote was well within my budget. So we just went for it. And he said, you know, it worked out very well and, you know, made, you know, well over 30 grand on that first flip. Whoa. So then I was like, you know, I was only looking to make about 4 on the wholesale. So then I was like, no, this rehabbing thing seems to be the better way.
There you go.
That is an interesting thing about wholesaling, right? Like if you're a really good wholesaler and you can get those amazingly cheap deals, it's hard to pass those deals up as a flipper and then hand them over to somebody else to make the 30 grand. I mean, I understand the velocity thing, but yeah, that's where I struggle. Anytime I get a good enough deal that I could wholesale, why would I wholesale it?
I the way I see it, wholesalers really, their job is the marketing. I mean, they're marketers versus versus flippers who are more jobbers, I guess, is maybe that's a way of describing it. And I don't mean negative on either of them, but you know, the wholesaler, your job is to get that flow, right? You want to work and get as many leads as possible, as quickly as possible, and you want to dump them as fast as possible. Yeah, you can have 10, 20, 30 deals in a month. You can't flip 10, 20, 30 deals in a month unless you have a huge infrastructure.
I think that's the big thing is just the difference in volume. So, you know, subsequently, I have wholesaled some properties, or I wholesaled a property. At the time I actually had like a lot of stuff coming in. It was a very magical time where it was the second property I got under contract that day after getting one under contract 2 days earlier and had multiple projects going. So it's like, oof, it's actually going to be hard to get stuff going. So I wasn't able to wholesale that. But for the most part, I don't get enough leads that I can't handle them.
Yep.
So, you know, if I started having more projects that I could reasonably take on at once, I'd be looking at that more. And subsequently, over the last couple of years, I have built up a stronger network, even out in that western part of the state where I had a hard time wholesaling this first one. So I don't worry about getting stuff in places that I would not necessarily want to do the job myself, because I am much more confident that I can, you know, dump them if I needed to.
Gotcha. All right. So where are you getting your leads from?
So up until about a year ago, I was pretty much exclusively doing stuff on the MLS because there was enough bank-owned stuff I was able to get deals, and I was putting in a lot of offers and getting things to work out. Especially, I did pretty well with HUD around here. Like I said, that first one was a HUD, and I got quite a few other ones that way. Since then, it's definitely been the MLS, like a lot of places in the country, have dried up a lot. So I'm actually currently just getting a lot of my direct marketing to motivated sellers going. So, you know, I have not purchased any properties from that yet, but I'm definitely working on it. You know, if people see me on the forums, I've been pretty active in a lot of the ones talking about, like, you know, direct mails and stuff like that to try to get new ideas, and been blogging about my stuff on my BP blog to kind of keep myself accountable.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And they can check that out. We'll link to that on the show notes at biggerpockets.com/show46. But so let's talk about that a little bit, and maybe we could jump back to the flipping stuff afterwards. So direct marketing to motivated sellers, you know, you're new to this, which makes it actually kind of interesting. You know, what strategy have you, did you decide to go with, you know, after doing all this research? You know, what are you running with? Who are you targeting specifically in terms of the motivated guys? And how is that going? I mean, obviously you haven't closed the deal yet, but, you know, fill us in a little bit.
So the main, you know, main form that I'm trying to use is direct mail. Because based on, you know, what I've talked to people locally and, you know, most of the stuff that I've read on Bigger Pockets has, you know, convinced me that that is probably the most effective way to go. So I've been working on that. In addition to that, I've been doing, you know, some of the more low hanging fruit, like posting Craigslist ads, getting in touch with people who post, you know, post for sale ads there. I finally took the plunge into tacky and started putting signs on my car.
Nice.
How does the fam feel about that?
You know, my wife has been surprisingly not bad with it.
Surprisingly mediocre.
Well, like, she hasn't said, like, take them off or anything, but which I was worried she might be like, oh, I can't, you know, at least when we do go places together, I figured she'd probably be okay, like, when I was by myself, but, like, you know, when I take him to like a kid's birthday party or something like that, like she doesn't ask me to take him off the car. Nice. So that's kind of where I thought she would go. So, you know, she's been cool with that.
Nice.
You know, just a lot of the common stuff, like, you know, leaving stacks of business cards in different places and, you know, those kind of like, you know, simplistic things that aren't particularly effective, but are easy to do.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So as far as the direct mail, I've only been doing, not even quite a month yet, been sending stuff out, been doing in sort of chunks to just start getting stuff out, because I was sort of like working on a list for a long time, and then I realized, you know, if I wait to fully refine everything I'm doing, I'm never going to send out any mail.
Yeah.
So I started sending out stuff a little more piecemeal.
And who are you sending to specifically?
I am sending to out-of-state absentee owners.
Okay.
The main reason for that is that it was a list I was able to compile myself for free.
There you go.
So I figured that was a good way to start until, you know, kind of keep the cost down until I figure get a better strategy and kind of feel my way through the actual process.
And how were you able to get those for free?
I am a licensed agent and was able to pull the information off MLS.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Do you,
it was actually for the Massachusetts MLS. There's, it's a pretty easy system. And actually, Mike LaCava in one of his articles a couple months ago, you know, showed the process for that. So that's actually where I learned how to do it.
Oh, that's awesome.
On the Bigger Pockets.
Ah, look at that. Power of Bigger Pockets. Nice.
Awesome. Awesome.
Yeah, that's cool. So do you recommend other people getting their real estate agent license? I ask a lot of our guests this.
I think I'm going to come down where everybody who has their license says that they should.
Yep.
Because I found it pretty beneficial to, you know, if for nothing else, just for the MLS access and the ability to put in my own offers on stuff that is like bank owned and short sales and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So you're not paying the commissions. You can expedite the rate at which you get it done. You don't have to wait for somebody else to respond to you. Those are definitely benefits.
Yeah, I like it. I especially like it on the buy side because, like I said, I can research stuff on MLS. I can comp stuff out. I can go do my own visits without having to schedule with a realtor, and I can put in my own offers.
And which would come in handy when, like you said, you're putting in, you know, a couple hundred offers in that first month. Like your agent,
exactly.
No agent's going to want to do that for some.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. So you have no, you know, because we talk with a bunch of agents, Brandon and I, and we're always asking them, hey, how can we improve the relationship between agents and investors. And agents, lo and behold, will always say, you know, get them to stop doing that crap where they send out a ton of offers that that have little chance of succeeding. And you think about it, how on earth can you get, you know, 100 offers out that, you know, with a 1 or 2 or 3, 4 or 5% success rate, you know, most agents are going to tell you to piss off, right? Yep. So really the only way to do it is to do it on your own.
Yeah. I mean, if somebody else was asking me to put out as many offers as I put out as an agent just for the commission, I wouldn't do it.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw a thing yesterday on a Facebook group. I'm part of, you know, a real estate agent Facebook group, and somebody had complained just about that. They said, you know, investors are asking me to put in, you know, 50 hours a month worth of work just to make, you know, the potential of making a few hundred bucks in commission on a $12,000 house. Like, it's just, it's ridiculous. Like, there's no incentive for these agents at all. And that's something we need to understand as investors.
Yeah, and I mean, I think in my area, I actually have better success like working with agents, because even like the beater up like needs tons of workplaces are at least approaching $100,000. So like, you know, they actually are getting, you know, a reasonable commission on the buy side. And so even though I'm an agent, I'm perfectly happy to work with other agents. So like when I network and I meet people, I was like, hey, I'm an agent, but if you bring me a deal, you can write the offer for me and I'll list the resale with you.
Oh, okay.
So that's sort of their incentive.
Okay. Nice. No, that's cool.
And I actually do list quite a few of my flips with other agents, just because, you know, I just don't think I'm that great at selling places. I do list some of my own stuff, and it's like places that are close to me, or if there's like, you know, some particular reason why I don't think that I could use like a local person with the specialized knowledge and stuff like that. But I would, you know, probably 60% of the places I've resold, I've had with other agents.
That is really interesting to me, because you know, a lot of investors say, you know, all an agent's doing is sticking it on the MLS and that's it. So why am I paying them, you know, 3 or 6% or whatever just to stick it on the MLS? So I would love to get your take on that. Like, what does a good agent do to sell a house that just throwing it on the MLS doesn't accomplish?
It's kind of hard to say. Like, I have overall had better success selling my places fast when I've listed them with other people.
Okay.
But, you know, I kind of go back and forth. I would say half the time when I list a place myself, like, you know, I sell it pretty easy and then I save on the commission. I'm just like, ugh, why do I waste that money listing with other people? And then the other half of the time, it is such a pain in the butt that I'm like, oh my God, this is the worst 3% I ever could have saved.
Yeah. Yeah, well, listen, I mean, a good agent, I think I could answer that. I mean, as a former agent who was never particularly good either. I wasn't a list, you know, I was a buyer's agent. I was never a listing agent. But, you know, I think what I saw that the good listing agents did was they got a lot of energy for the listing beforehand. There's that age old argument about open houses. Agents all complain that open houses are useless. But, you know, I think if the house looks good and the house is ready to go, an open house can sell your house pretty fast. So, you know, getting energy about the house, getting it out to other agents, you know, making deals with other agents and letting them know that you've got this, you know, this great property. Just like an investor, it's about networking. So a good agent is going to be somebody who's very well networked, who's tight with the other investors in the area, and who has the capacity to go out and basically bring you buyers. I mean, that's really what it comes down to.
Yeah.
So if you've got a good agent, they're gonna have a lead funnel, just like an investor is gonna have a lead funnel as well, and you know, they're just gonna have the capacity to do that. I think, you know, that's really the biggest difference between a good agent and a quote mediocre agent is, you know, and the other thing is also just the willingness to spend the money on the marketing. You know, good agents will spend money and they'll market it because they know they're going to see it back, and they'll put their name all over the neighborhood. They'll do whatever they have to do because it will come back and pay itself back. The mediocre ones tend to chintz out, I think, on their spend. That's just my take on it.
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate overall. So, you know, when I have, like I said, when I've listed with other people, generally I've had better success moving the places pretty quick. Not always, but, you know, generally I think I've had more advantages that way. Never really gotten any traction, either open houses I've done or the ones that they've done, but something that they bring to the table usually that I don't really have is they do broker opens. So yeah, they get other agents through there, which is a big thing. So my office is a small, independent, quote-unquote, investor-friendly office. Like the little like motto is like, you know, investors working with other investors. So like, yeah, you know, all the agents more or less are doing their own kind of investing as well. That's so cool. Like we don't have like a strong retail branch.
Yeah.
So these other people can bring in like people from their offices. And if they're, you know, with one of the bigger companies, some of the other local offices.
Yeah. Yeah. I think broker opens are, you know, I'd say they're probably more valuable than just a open house to consumers because, you know, giving the opportunity for other folks, other brokers to show up, other agents to come and know it, you know, when they've got a client, that's where it's going to come from. So yeah, when I was an agent in California, that was the one thing that I saw on the most successful listing guys. They always held a broker open. They got excitement. You know, they it costs the best way to buy, by the way, to do a broker open is to have a bunch of food. The broker opens that didn't have food, nobody showed up for.
Nobody went to those.
Yeah. Yep. And the broker opens that had a nice little catering that you probably spent a couple $100 on brought everybody in, and those houses really tended to sell fast. So it's you know, you never think about those things, but those are it's actually pretty important.
In my town, we have a they call it the tour. There's like probably 24 agents that get together every Wednesday. You know, they just go all together from different brokers. I mean, I'm in a small area, and they just go and look at every single new property that came on the market in the past week, or at least every, you know, one within their, you know, whatever niche that they're in. And that's one of my favorite things about listing with an agent is exactly that. Almost every property I've sold has come as a result somehow of an agent who had walked through the house during that tour. So I think it's huge.
Yeah, like I said, I've gotten a lot more traction from those than I have, like, you know, the consumer open houses.
Yeah.
I think at least two places sold to an agent that went through one of those, or, you know, to a client of an agent who went through one of those that we did. So, yeah, I definitely like doing that. And always when I talk to the agents, I ask them to do that.
Cool. Well, hey, let's go back to flipping a little bit and talk more about your kind of strategy with that. So first of all, what kind of properties are you flipping? What are you looking for condition-wise or size-wise, those kind of things?
So I actually cast a pretty wide net, both like geographically and in what kind of properties I'll do and what level of rehab I'm willing to do. Essentially, the deal flow is small enough that I'm willing to chase dollars and go pretty far out and do a variety of kind of things. So I have done, let's see, I haven't done anything smaller than a 2-bedroom house at this point, but I have told people I'm willing to look at, you know, like small. So as I mentioned, I have some experience with condos, so those don't scare me, even on the flip side. So I do tell people I'm willing to look at those, like as small as, you know, 1-bedrooms, if it's, you know, it's like in the city or something where people actually do buy those.
Yeah.
And I have looked at up to small multifamily, 2 or 3 families for potential flips in areas where, you know, it's not uncommon to have owner occupants there. So like I said, I do a whole wide range there. But, you know, for the most part, it's been 2 and 3-bedroom single families.
Okay.
Right on.
Cool. And are they usually pretty, I mean, like nasty, ugly, you need to do a complete renovation, or are they?
Yeah, pretty much. There's some exceptions. I had one place that was kind of funny. So I had put in a bid on this place. It was a HUD property. I put a bid on it without seeing it. I kind of do a lot of analysis, desktop analysis, just kind of putting in worst case scenarios, and I'll throw in some offers based on that. So I got so they accepted my offer, which I was surprised about. I usually just hope to see like a counter offer. So I like rushed down to go look at the place, and I had something like, I want to say I had like a $75,000 budget on the place. And I walked in the front door, and then I literally took a step back to look at the house number to make sure I was in the right house, because it was so not that bad. Which was kind of funny because if you anybody who knows about, so as I said, I'm an agent and I'm a HUD registered agent. So like basically my office has a set of keys that work with all the HUD locks for the places all around the state. So like I had a key to the front door, yet I still was so shocked that I took a step back to see if I was in the right place.
Nice. Okay, so you know, on show 38 with Travis Daggett, we talked a lot about HUD homes and making offers on them, and it's kind of cool that you're a HUD agent. So we kind of get to see what it's like from your perspective as well. Maybe you could dig in a little bit on the HUD process really, really quickly for those who may not have listened and may be unfamiliar. Just like, what's HUD? How does it get listed? And you know, how would you make an offer on a HUD home? So, you know, where would you find these things?
So being that I am an agent and my brokerage is registered with HUD, it's very easy to deal with those properties because you have, if you want to put in an offer, you have to put it in through a HUD registered agent. So, you know, if you're not an agent or if you're an agent and your brokerage isn't registered with HUD, then you have that extra step to go through. And then all the stuff that we were just talking about as far as like knowing the other agents by, you know, putting in too low offers and that sort of thing. Since I don't have that hang up, it's if you can put in your own offers, it's like ridiculously easy. It's like it's just a one page form that you have to fill out for the property. You can't put in any particular contingencies. You just have to fill out the basic information. I can put in a HUD offer in less than 2 minutes once I do the evaluation.
That's cool. Mm-hmm.
And I do that a lot and put in a lot of them. And I put in ridiculously low offers that I don't expect to ever get accepted. I'm just hoping to get like a counter offer that's like within the realm of possibility.
So I'm assuming you don't go look at these properties first then, right?
I don't think I've ever looked at a HUD property before I put in an offer in on it.
Okay. Yeah.
Is there a danger, you know, like putting in too many lowball offers for an agent, they're going to say, you know, go away, stop making these offers. Is there a danger that HUD stops responding to you because you're that annoying guy who always puts in these awful lowball offers?
It seems for the most part to be very automated and it doesn't seem to matter. There was one time I got an email from somebody at one of the asset management companies asking if I knew how to use the system because my offer was so low. I think I offered like $1,200 on a place that was listed at $120,000.
you really do lowball offers. Okay.
Well, basically, if I spend the time for a HUD,
yeah.
This is not the same on every particular place. But like I said, yeah, since I don't see any ramifications, if I bother putting in, if I do the evaluation, I'm putting in an offer.
Yeah.
No matter how stupid it is.
Well, I think that's an awesome strategy to do. Yeah. I mean, if you're going to spend the time anyway and you find out what that final number is that you should offer, why not throw it in? At least you never know what might happen.
Yeah. Well, what's funny with that, so like, I will resubmit offers every once in a while. Like, you know, even if I only, what I generally do is like I increment it up a dollar just so like I know, you know, they're looking at my most recent offer or something. Yeah. That is if I don't have any other reason to change it. But for this particular one, after they like said that I didn't put in more offers on it, but they kept sending me counter offers for weeks. So I'm like, well, you know what? If you're going to keep countering my $1,200 offer, then I don't really feel bad about putting it in.
Yeah.
Wait, so you're putting in, say it's $100,000. You put an offer at 12, say 10,000, right? Say you made a generous offer knowing you. No, I'm just kidding. So you put in this $10,000 offer. They counter you at 95 and you counter them at 10,001 and they counter you at what?
Well, so like I said, it's a pretty automated system. What they typically do is they just send out an email like to basically anybody who put in an offer being like, you know, we have decided this is the minimum net offer that HUD is willing to accept on this. And they basically just send it to everybody. And that's sort of what I'm looking at. So if you put in an offer, you'll get that email generally. So that's sort of what I'm looking at. So, you know, like, yeah, I don't remember exactly what you said, but, you know, say the place is listed at 100,000, you know, I put in a $10,000 offer. They come back and say, you know, not as low as you are, as high as you have, but say they come back at like 70. Mm-hmm. So then I was like, okay, well, maybe if I go out there, you know, drive the neighborhood to see if I can, you know, if my ARV might be on the low side, because I try to be conservative with that until I look at the property, obviously. And it, maybe I can do my rehab, like the place I was talking about where, you know, I thought I was in the wrong house. Like, you know, my rehab budget dropped $50,000 as soon as I walked in the front door. So like, you know, if I can tighten up the budget, maybe this will be workable. So that's kind of where, you know, that's when I'll start putting in the time.
Is that 70 that they come back to you at? Is that hard and firm, or is there a negotiation?
Nope, they'll keep coming down.
So how does that work? I mean, so if you counter again, do you get another standardized?
It's not really a counter. It's more kind of like you can resubmit an offer. Like, it's not like when you deal with an agent, you can like verbally go back and forth and then just, you know, update the contract. It's like you just keep, you would submit a new offer. If you, you know, if you wanted to get the property at the price that they said, you would just make sure that it netted out to the, and it's a net amount. So like they take into account the commissions and closing cost credits and stuff like that. So if you put in the offer, so it nets out to the amount they want, and, you know, unless somebody else goes higher than that, you're pretty much guaranteed to get it. I did that one time that I put in exactly what they asked for on the counter because they had just dropped the price and they said they would accept something like 10 grand under what the new price was. And it was pretty much like what my Mayo was.
Well, tell me about the counter then. I'm going to call it a counter, right? The second offer, fine. Third offer.
15th offer.
Yeah. Well, when do you do it?
Generally, I have it sort of on a weekly, every other weekly kind of cycle where if I already have, so like I said, unless I have some other reason to change my offer, I just sort of increment it up a buck just so like I know they're, because actually on that very first property I was talking about, I adjusted my offer a couple different times and they actually accepted an earlier offer than the most current one. Which kind of got me, you know, I was indignant about that, but then I went and drove, looked at the property and it's like, okay, well, it still works, even though this is like $3,000 more than what I most recently asked for. So instead of rocking the boat, I just did it. But so now what I do is I make sure I put in my rock bottom offer first and then I'll increment up from there just to make sure, you know, that kind of thing doesn't happen again.
And I'm assuming that's worked.
Yeah.
It has. Okay. So you've closed.
Well, because always my most recent offer is always my highest now. Yeah, so that's the one that they're evaluating. You know, even if it is only higher by a dollar, it's still the highest.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Whether you need to buy or sell, or you're just obsessed with looking at homes for sale, Redfin's got you covered. Redfin updates their listings every 2 minutes to help you see new homes first. And they give you personalized recommendations based on the homes you like, so you can find a home that's just right for you, whether that's a cabin, a craftsman, or a castle. With the top-rated Redfin app, you can favorite homes, share listings with others, and schedule tours even on the same day with a local Redfin agent who can help guide you through the whole home buying process. And if you're looking to sell, Redfin agents have the experience to help you get the best price possible for your home. That's because they sell twice as many homes as other agents. With a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin's fees are half of what others often charge, which means you'll have more money to put towards what matters most to you, like your next home. In fact, last year, Redfin saved home sellers $127 million. No matter where you are in your real estate journey, Redfin can help. Download the Redfin app to get started today. We're always looking for ways to improve, searching for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for better is by matching with quality candidates. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of the show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BiggerPockets. Just go to Indeed.com/BiggerPockets right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Indeed.com/BiggerPockets. Need to hire? You need Indeed. You're trying to close on your next rental, so why is your insurance company dragging its feet? With long lead times and never-ending paper forms, it's no wonder it takes forever to finally get a policy. Modern investors deserve better. They deserve Steadily.com. At steadily.com, you'll get fast, affordable landlord insurance available online 24/7 in just a few clicks. You can even get next day coverage, which takes just minutes, by the way, to obtain. And you can do it all from your phone. Steadily was founded by landlords who created insurance products tailored to the unique needs of this industry. It's their sole focus, and that's why landlords nationwide consistently rate them 4.8 out of 5 stars. So whether you've got a single family, short-term, or multifamily portfolio, Steadily.com can secure the best coverage at the best price to protect your properties. Discover how Steadily can save you both time and money on your rental property insurance. Visit Steadily.com for a commitment-free quote tailored to your needs today. Real estate investing is great, but for some, the tenant phone calls and clogged toilets aren't all that attractive. So how do you invest in real estate without getting your hands dirty? Invest for truly passive income with Pine Financial Group. Pine's mortgage fund offers a targeted 8% preferred return and an attractive profit split, with 70% of net profits going to the investors. You'll earn passive income by participating in lending to house flippers. And it's secure because senior lien holders, that's you, are first in line to get paid. Their rigorous underwriting process and the backing of a physical asset mitigate downside risk. Plus, by investing with Pine Financial Group, you contribute to the revitalization of communities by directing your funds from Wall Street to Main Street and supporting local economies. The investment is reserved for accredited investors. Don't miss this opportunity to back Main Street over Wall Street and start earning passive real estate income. Learn more about investing with Pine at pinefinancialgroup.com/BP. pinefinancialgroup.com/BP.
Let's move on. What is the cheapest home you've ever bought? Like, how low can you go on these things?
Well, so locally in Massachusetts, it would have been that very first property I was talking about that was like around $34,000. I actually bought another one. My most recent one a few months ago was also in that same 30 grand range, which, like I said, is ridiculously low in Massachusetts. Both of those needed much more work than, like, the cost of the work was much more than the price of the house.
Okay, yeah.
But so, as I mentioned, I do some out-of-state rentals. So in that market, things are much, much, much cheaper. Like, even the very nice houses don't cost me that much. The cheapest house I bought ever was $2,000. I bought that at a tax sale in Pennsylvania.
Wow. Okay. So $2,000, and that came totally without any kind of secondary liens or anything?
Yeah, free and clear.
Okay. Okay.
Wow.
And what was that house actually worth?
It's probably worth somewhere in the low to mid 20s.
Okay. Gotcha.
But it's a much cheaper market out there. And also, this place was inhabited when I bought it. So, I'm actually in the process of trying to figure out what's going on with the people. If they're actually tenants who don't, I guess, have a current lease. So we're trying to see if they want to stay, if they want to go, if we're going to have to evict them. So that's a little bit up in the air. But, obviously the place is fully inhabitable if people are already living there. I'm sure it needs some work, but, I'm kind of hoping to get them to stay for a slightly below market rent so I don't have to do turnover costs.
Yeah. Did you buy that sight unseen again, I'm guessing?
Obviously we couldn't get inside. We did go around the outside, and for the most part, the exterior was in pretty good shape. It was hard to tell, didn't even want to appear in the windows once it was clear people live there.
Yeah.
You can at least look in the windows of places that are vacant. But, we saw people were living there. We saw, the electric meter moving and stuff like that. So we're like, okay, let's just get out of here before people call the cops for trespassing.
Yeah.
So you actually did you go to the courthouse steps to buy that then?
That's not exactly how it works, but yeah, more or less it was an auction hall at the municipal building.
Okay.
But yes,
yeah, same kind of thing. Okay, well,
same idea. Yeah.
So then, what are these properties in this area looking like? Price wise or condition like? What are you looking for down in Pennsylvania? You said.
Yeah, it's in western Pennsylvania, right near Ohio.
Okay.
Like, well west of Pittsburgh.
Okay. So, yeah, what do they look like down there?
They don't look too different from what I have up here. They're, an older housing stock. Not super old. It's more like, World War II-y, World War I, World War II, which, given that I'm from New England, that's like new construction.
Yeah. Nice. Nice.
But, they're pretty typical houses. They're, there's you know, like every other place, you're going to have your really nice houses, and you're going to have your really dumpy ones. But, you know, for the most part, I'm looking at there's some two bedroom places, but mostly you're kind of like 3-1.5, 3-2 type places, like pretty good square footage.
What kind of price range are you seeing?
So the stuff that I'm looking at, because obviously I'm not looking at like the higher end stuff for rentals, you know, these places like in really good, fully rehabbed condition are probably like, you know, in the 30s.
And what are you picking them up for?
So I've gotten stuff anywhere from that $2,000 house to the most I've paid for a place so far was a fully rehabbed duplex for $37,500.
Wow. And what are those renting for?
The duplex I'm getting, what's it, total rent of about $1,000.
Okay. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, it's not bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I had another place. So this was a place I bought right off of MLS. It was move-in, more or less move-in ready. I did have to do a little bit of work to it, but it only cost me $17,000 and renting that for $575.
Okay, that's cool.
Did have to put a little bit of work in, so I'm probably all in before getting rent for still under 20, but probably more like, you know, 18.5, 19.
That's still pretty good. All right, Sean. So let's talk about mistakes. You know, we all make them. You know, it's funny. I get these investors who will email me and say, you know, Josh, I have to close my profile because I talked about a mistake I made, and now nobody's going to take me seriously. And I'm like, listen, you know, if you're a real estate investor, you've made mistakes. You know, nobody's going to give you any less credit because you've made mistakes. They'll treat you differently if you're a liar. You know.
Yes.
I closed a profile of somebody today who, you know, was one of those. Hey, I've got $1 billion in real estate available. And at the same time, he's asking for money to help him flip a house. Yeah. Well, right. I don't know. That doesn't really work so well together. But yeah, so don't do that, by the way, for anyone listening. Don't.
Quick tip.
That was good. I might fire Brandon and bring you in.
Hey, okay. I can take it.
Yeah, but you're totally right. It's all about honesty. Like, you can't, you know, you don't have to be an expert in everything. And like, you know, people make mistakes. They might say something wrong. But like, yeah, you have to be upfront and honest and try to be above board on everything.
Yeah. So let's talk about mistakes. What mistakes really stand out to you that you've experienced in your career thus far?
Well, one of my funniest mistakes is, so going back to that very first property that I talked about that I went to try to wholesale and eventually rehabbed. So when I was doing my evaluation, I had in my head the wrong place where the house was. So like I said, I hadn't seen the house. I was just doing you know, an online evaluation, you know, desktop rehab analysis based on the size of the house and, you know, doing comps on MLS, which doesn't necessarily tell you where the house is. So I went to go put in my offer, and like I had in my head that it was probably, you know, about 40 miles south of Boston. I put it in Google Maps and it turned out to be 90 miles west. Mm. So I put in this offer on this house and I had absolutely no idea where it was.
Nice.
That's a pretty good mistake.
Okay, that's a good one. So know where your properties are when you're making offers. That's a good
That helps. Yeah. I haven't been that far off since.
Okay. Well, there's a good one. You got any others?
You know, like I said, everybody makes lots of mistakes.
I don't. I'm perfect, actually.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. All right, keep going.
Around here we have a fair number of places that are still on septic systems. And we have pretty tight regulations around that as well. So I purchased a property that had, it's called a Title V. That's the name of the, you know, the law that you have to, you know, have this past inspection to be able to resell a house. Okay. Unless you're a bank. Anybody, you know, everybody else has to have a pass when a bank doesn't. So I did buy one of my HUD properties, had this past report, so I thought I was all set, didn't have to worry about septic, and I didn't do any follow-up. So, you know, you can go to the Board of Health and, like, check the records and stuff like that. I didn't bother doing that because I had this past report. That's, you know, generally all you need. And when I went to resell it, the buyer's agent was looking up some other stuff on the house, just looking for some old permits and stuff. Because, you know, like I said, it was a bank-owned property, so I disclosed that that's what it was. And I didn't have a good history on, like, how old the roof was, because we didn't do the roof. So she was looking for some, like, you know, old permits to try to get a gleam a better idea of that. And she noticed, quote unquote, something seemed funny with the septic reports. And eventually, like, we had to dig it up and get it reexamined. And the Board of Health, like, started making other things. Thank God that it was in good enough shape. We didn't have to replace it, but I did have to do some repair work on it. And that was about a $10,000 overage that I wasn't expecting, because, you know, I just had this report and, you know, I didn't verify stuff. So, you know, the old trust and verify.
Nice. Yeah, that could have been a dirty problem.
Hey, yeah. Before we go on to the end of the show, I want to ask you about something that you kind of teased me on the email about, and that was a property you bought. You said that was that you're not afraid of buying any type of property, and you said that
a
crazy one.
I look at, you know, I don't get all hung up like a lot of people do on buying, you know, nice houses and nice areas, like, you know, whatever. So this one particular place I was telling you about, literally across the street was a sewer pumping station in the backyard where train tracks, and I mean like serious train tracks, like, and right in the backyard, like not even 100 yards away from the back of the house. Ooh. And it was also in the flight path of the municipal airport for the city next door.
Oh.
It's also probably is in a flood zone now. It wasn't at the time, but with the new maps, I wouldn't be shocked if it was, because like down the street was. And it also bordered a town. Hey, since we're like banging on towns, Lawrence, Massachusetts, one of the crappiest cities in all of Massachusetts. It bordered that, like literally. So, you know, there was a sewer station, and then across the river was Lawrence. So being next to like one of the worst cities in the entire state was like only the fourth or fifth worst thing going for this house.
Wow. So what did you do with this thing?
I renovated and I flipped it.
Okay.
So, if you, my thing is, like, you know, like I said, I look at the prices. So this was a funny story. So I was looking at auction.com, and it was, you know, probably like midnight, 1 a.m. kind of thing. And there was an auction that was ending the next day. So, you know, even if I had this unhealthy obsession of looking at properties beforehand, I wouldn't have had a chance with this particular one. But it was going at a ridiculously low price. So this, the town is North Andover, which has pretty good schools, pretty high prices. Like, based on the size of this house, I was figuring it was a $250K ARV, and the opening bid was like $62,000-ish.
This is the one with the tracks behind it.
Exactly that one.
Okay.
So basically, I put a bid on it, being like, "Yeah, hey, it's never going to work." And then like the next day, I get the email being like, "Hey, you were the high bidder."
What did you bid?
It's 62.
Oh, you bid 62. Okay.
Yeah, I just put in the minimum bid. So then I was like, oh, you know, so obviously I'm just like super duper excited that's not true, because whenever I have an offer, I always get scared. It's like, what did I miss? Yeah. Which obviously in this particular case, I missed some stuff.
Yeah, little due diligence, right?
Yeah. So immediately, you know, went out there, got my contractor to come look at it. I had, as I said, I do a sight unseen budget. So I had a very high budget on the place, just assuming that was probably the issue, is that it needed tons and tons and tons of work. So I got out to the place, and essentially my ARV dropped $100,000 as soon as I pulled up to the house. And we went inside, but then it was actually in way better condition than we had expected. So then I was talking with the contractor. It's like, okay, you know, this is a lipstick on the pig. What can we do to make everything right without having to, you know, there's certain levels of work you can do before you have to start pulling permits and update everything to modern code. Like, we checked out all the plumbing and all the wiring and stuff. You know, there was no knob and tube wiring. It had, you know, circuit breakers, not a fuse box, all that kind of stuff. So, like, you know, everything was working okay. Like, obviously, if there were major problems like that, we would have had issues. But, like, you know, we didn't want to have to bring everything up to code by ripping down all the walls and stuff, because this also had a pretty bad floor plan. So we had to, you know, work with what we could without having to spend too much money. So we were able to come up with a reasonable budget, keeping it pretty low. And then, you know, basically was able to resell it, like I said, about 100 $100,000 under what most other places in that town were going for. Like literally the places that were my direct competition when I listed it were like the uninhabitable REOs and short sales that were still on the market.
Nice. All right. So what were the final numbers? You paid 62. You put how much in?
It was roughly like in the 30 range.
All right. You're at 92 and we sold it for?
160, 159.
Ooh. Oh, that's not bad.
In the end, it netted out because I also, so that was one of the properties I listed myself because I didn't think I needed an experienced agent to just underprice it by $100,000.
Yeah.
So including like the my portion of the commission, I made a little over $33,000 on it.
Wow. That's awesome. That's a good deal. So that kind of shows you that buying a property with a sewer plant in the back, railroad tracks in the front, or vice versa. Next to crappy, what is it, Lawrence,
Massachusetts.
Crapple. I grew up in Lawrence, New York, so you know. Yeah, all right. Well, the people of Detroit are happy to hear this interview, and yeah, so you could still make money.
Yeah, I mean, so you know, my key to buying these troubled, let's call them properties, is that you just have to buy them. You have to buy them, like any real estate, you have to buy them right. But like, you know, in this case, you have to take all that kind of stuff into account. You know, like I said, you know, these places, the uninhabitable REOs were selling for not much less than what I had my resale as because of these, you know, locational issues. So if I paid, you know, $100,000+ for the house, which actually it had been on MLS at 110. So like, you know, anybody could have bought it for that price, which was actually the cheapest place in the town at that time.
Gotcha.
But like wouldn't have made any money. I actually would have lost money on it at that price.
Yeah, makes sense. All right. So let's move on to our...
It's time for the fire round.
Fire round. These questions come from the Bigger Pockets forums, and we shout them out quickly at you, and you shout us some quick answers back. First question in today's fire round is, my handyman is ripping me off. What do you do? So obviously we're going to go and fire them, but how do we avoid this situation?
I mean, you know, it's tough. I would say one of the hardest things to do in real estate is find good, reliable contractors down to like handymen. I have been pretty lucky and I have a really, really good contractor that I try to do as much work with as I can because he works well with me, communicates good, and I think his prices are good. You know, he pretty much always comes in below what I have as my own estimates. Now, I try to be pretty conservative. So, you know, I kind of expect him to come in under, but like, you know, it's never been any kind of issue. I have, you know, knock on wood, haven't had price creep yet, that sort of thing. To be honest, I don't have a good handyman because I haven't ever been able to find one. So I actually use the contractor on stuff that I probably should use a handyman on, and probably am paying a little bit more because of that. But, you know, I actually have somebody who can do the work because I have not been able to find a good one.
Well, and that itself is the tip right there is, you know, if you have to pay more money, you know, pay more money and find somebody that's reliable.
And that yes, can do it. So. Very true.
Cool. All right. Next question. What color should you paint a kitchen in a flip? Same color as the rest of the house or something different?
I've gone a couple different ways. I have gone like, you know, not super bold, but like, you know, different color scheme in the kitchens. And I would say sometimes it's worked out for me. Other times people have talked about how like, oh, you know, we don't like this color and we might want to repaint it. And they try to use that as leverage. It's like, well, you know, sorry, you don't like it. I'm not going to like knock 10 grand off the price of the house because you want to repaint the kitchen that I just painted. So we've actually gone more towards using the fairly neutral colors that we're using throughout the rest of the house there as well.
All right. What's the best way to get started with no money?
If you don't have any money, I've found if you can get a good deal, I don't have any trouble getting a hard money lender to finance pretty much all of it if you have enough meat in it.
Okay, good. What's the best type of property to buy first?
Well, I guess it depends on what you're looking to do. Like I said, I actually liked buying the condos for rentals because, like I said, it makes it a little bit easier getting your feet with property management.
Okay.
Right on. Well, we're going to cut this one a little bit short because I know you're a little short on time. Let's move to our famous
is for.
Nice. Dave.
That was all Sean. That was all Sean. All right, Sean. First question is, what is your favorite real estate book?
So I'm going to be cliche like everybody else and say that Rich Dad Poor Dad was a big one. But actually, I kind of liked a few of the follow-up books like The Cashflow Quadrant and The Guide to Investing was some pretty good ones.
Oh, cool. Right on.
I also like Nothing Down, so the Robert Allen kind of classic.
Yep.
You know, I don't think a lot of that stuff is necessarily applicable anymore just because a lot of laws have changed in the last like 30 or 40 years, but it's still a good, you know, kind of book to get your mindset.
Yeah, I agree. All right, what's your favorite non-real estate business book?
So again, going to be cliche, E-Myth.
Okay, yep.
I also like The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, which I know somebody mentioned on one of the recent podcasts. That's a great one.
Yeah.
That's a great way just to live your entire life, not just your business.
There you go.
And another one that I've liked recently is called Getting Things Done by David Allen.
I love that book.
GTD.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah. Awesome. Cool. Cool. Yeah. Good.
Yeah, we'll link to those in the show notes. So.
Yeah.
All right. Awesome. Hobbies. I beat you to it.
Well, I have two small daughters, so that monopolizes most of my time.
Yep.
But, you know, I do love that, like spending time with my family and playing with my kids and stuff. That really is my favorite thing. You know, personally, I like sports, watching sports as part of my life, but cool. I enjoy that, you know. Go Red Sox, World
go
Series.
Go Mets.
Actually, we've got to be going to Game 6 of the World Series tonight, so hopefully it's a win and they wrap it up.
Yeah, we'll see. This comes out in a few weeks, so we'll...
Yeah, a couple weeks.
Yeah, people will look back and either laugh right now or...
Yeah.
Cheer you on. All right, final question. What do you believe sets apart the successful investors from those who end up giving up and failing?
I think that's exactly it, is just sticking with it.
Okay.
If you, you know, you do see people like in the forums talk about, oh, I sent out this, you know, I sent out 500 letters and I didn't even get like one good lead out of it. It's like, you know, you just got to keep following up. You just got to keep making offers. I mean, I made probably 600 offers before I got that first like wholesale slash flip property under contract. Wow. My hit rate is terrible. Now, I told you I put in a lot of low offers, but, you know, my hit rate is pretty low on that. So I've put out thousands and thousands of offers to buy dozens of properties.
That's cool.
It's a strategy. I actually always say there's two kinds of real estate investors. Those that make a ton of money and those who give up too soon.
Yep. That's good. Okay. That's good. Yeah, I like that quote. That's a tweetable topic. We'll add it in.
Yeah. And I know I definitely couldn't do it your way, man. I wouldn't have the fortitude to put in thousands of offers. That's tough. It's really hard. Yeah.
You got to have a pretty thick skin because you definitely get people mad at you and you definitely, you know, get a lot of rejection. And like I said, some of the properties I buy that, you know, the sewer play place, shockingly, you know, there were issues that came up and, you know, had to deal with them. So,
yeah,
you know, it is definitely easier to just buy the 1800 square foot with an attached garage in a nice neighborhood type places. But, you know,
yep.
Different strokes for different folks.
Exactly.
Man. For sure. For sure. All right, Sean. Well, listen, we want to thank you a lot for being on the show. We definitely appreciate it. And we look forward to seeing you back on the site.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks a lot, guys. I really appreciate it. And one last quick tip. Yes. Anybody who is listening to this who is not a Bigger Pockets member, go to the site. It is an awesome site, and it's going to have all the information that you need to learn about to get started in real estate investing. Josh and Brandon did not ask me to do this. I didn't even tell them I was going to do this. Totally unsolicited.
Nice. Little strange.
Oh, thank you.
Kind of stalkerish.
I love you guys.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it, man. Thanks so much. And
it's been good.
All right, well, thank you guys.
All right. We'll talk to you later.
All right. So that was Sean Riley. Lots of cool stuff in that show. We jumped around a little bit, but there's a lot of fascinating little tidbits. Definitely hope you enjoyed it. And we appreciate you listening to the show, guys.
Make sure you connect with Sean over on Bigger Pockets too. So send a call request and jump into the show notes and ask questions.
Yeah, yeah. Sean's pretty active on the site. He's active on the forums. Very active on our member blog area as well. So be sure to interact. Otherwise, as always, you know, thank you. Check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/biggerpockets. Twitter.com/biggerpockets. We're on G+. We're everywhere else. And come hang out with us on Bigger Pockets, as Sean suggested. And that's about it. Brandon, I appreciate having you as a host. You're really great to work with, man.
Even if I can't say Massachusetts,
look at that. Oh, you did it. Nicely done, my friend. Well, why don't you take it out this time? Seriously, I think
seriously
I'm
this time.
Seriously,
right. This okay. is Brandon signing off.
You're listening to Bigger Pockets Radio, simplifying real estate for investors large and small. If you're here looking to learn about real estate investing without all the hype, you're in the right place. Be sure to join the millions of others who have benefited from BiggerPockets.com, your home for real estate investing online.
Damn it, Newman. I couldn't even get the intro right.
There's a reason small multifamily investing is so popular in the Bigger Pockets community. With just a 3.5% down payment, you can own up to 4 different units. Think about it. If you house hack and live in one of the units, you still have 3 different groups of tenants helping you pay down your mortgage every month. 4 kitchens and bathrooms you could renovate to increase your property value. 4 different Airbnbs, medium-term rentals, or other rental strategies that you can try in one property, all in just one transaction. Of course, the question is, where do you find a small multifamily property that you can actually afford? Which market and which deals are best for you? Once you close, how do you manage it, optimize it, keep scaling, and living your life without being tied down to 4 leaky toilets or 4 fussy tenants? All great questions, my friends. All to be answered in the upcoming Small Multifamily Bootcamp with Chris Lopez and Leka Devatha. So if you're serious about growing your portfolio with this highly efficient strategy, head to biggerpockets.com/4, F-O-U-R, today and join us in the Small Multifamily Bootcamp. See you there.
The content of this podcast is for informational purposes only.
Past performance is not indicative of future results, and all hosts and participant opinions are their own.
Investment in any asset, real estate included, involves risk. Use your best judgment and consult with qualified advisors before investing. Only risk capital you can afford to lose.
Bigger Pockets LLC disclaims all liability for direct, indirect, consequential, or other damages arising from reliance upon information presented in this podcast.